thank you for downloading or streaming this episode of Band Biographies. You can find more episodes at bandbiographies.com. That's B-A-N-N-E-D biographies.com. If you enjoy it, why not leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or whatever service you use to listen to your podcasts? Apparently, it helps get the show up the charts so more people can see it, to download it, and then to leave further 5-star reviews. Another way you can help is by telling as many friends as possible to give it a download. Please do reach out on Twitter at BandBiogs, on Instagram at BandBiographies, search on Facebook for BandBiographies, or by emailing bandbiographies@gmail.com. But most of all, enjoy. Hello, and welcome to this special interview episode of the Band Biographies podcast with me, Tom Austin Morgan. Today's episode is a conversation I had with Chris Constantino. He may be better known to some of you Adamant fans as Chris De Niro. He's also played in bands with Marco Peroni, Annabella Lewin, and Rat Scabies, which cover everything from blues to dance music. Currently, he's about to release a new mini-album called Femme Power with rapper Jenna Dickens in a punk rap project called Rude Girl and CC. Femme Power will be available to stream and buy on the 6th of May 2022 and is released through InGrooves, part of the Universal Music Group. The lead track, King Kong, will also be played by Iggy Pop on his BBC Radio 6 music show on that day. Later in June, they'll also be releasing a double A-side through Cleopatra Records. The tracks are called I'm Good, which has been mixed by Nick Hodgson of the Kaiser Chiefs, and the second track is a version of Adamant's Goody Two Shoes, so keep your eyes peeled for those dropping. Chris and I got on like a house on fire, and this episode was edited down from a 2-hour conversation we had that went way off topic at certain points where we just got to know each other, which was really cool, but probably not very interesting to you. I mean, who knows, if I start a Patreon at some point, maybe I'll start releasing the unedited versions of these interviews, and perhaps the videos as well. But I digress. I'm sure you're going to enjoy this one. Chris has certainly lived a life, and you're going to hear just a fraction of it now. I was listening to Iggy Pop's pronunciation, and I thought, I don't know whether that's 100% right.
That was funny, wasn't it? You know what I was thinking? I was thinking, like, maybe that's a Russian sort of pronunciation of it, because it sounded very odd, didn't it? Or maybe it was just an Iggy Pop sort of pronunciation.
An Iggyism.
Yeah.
That's cool, man. But so thanks very much for coming on the show, Chris. Really appreciate your time. I hope that you had a nice time away over Christmas and New Year to your retreat as well. Is that something that you do quite often?
I don't do it that often. It was just that it came up, and it was like, it was just an opportunity that came up, and I'd never done one before. I've never been on like a retreat, and
what
I thought,
was it like a yogic retreat or something like that?
Yeah, it was. it was an ashram, and which is even worse. So I kind of like thought, I thought, oh my god, this is going to be like, I'm going to hate it. So I thought, you know, but I've got push my boundaries, and I kind of like thought, you know, at my age I should be sort of thinking of trying new things, and so I thought, okay, I'll give it a go, and I'll just leave my suitcase packed, and if I don't like it, I can just leave. So I arrived and had my suitcase. It was sort of, you know, just had it open and just ready to go, really. Had a hire car, so I thought, you know, I thought, this is going to be weird. I might have to leave. So I got there, and it was kind of, I threw myself into it. And after the first day, I realized it was like being on the road, like with a band. And it was just like that you'd not, but like guys, you just, the first time you've been on the road together. So I loved it. I started to really enjoy it. And very new experience.
What kind of things do they do at those ashrams?
Well, they do different things, don't they? I mean, this one was kind of like quite loose. I mean, they started off trying to be a bit strict, but I thought, this is bollocks. And I just said, you know, it's like sort of, I think on the first night I went to my room, and like people were like texting saying, where are you? And I said, oh, I'm just in my room having a drink. You know, I think I had some red wine or something. And they said, oh, why don't you come down? We'll all have some. And I said, well, I don't think it's allowed. And I knew the yoga teacher, Emma, and she said, oh, no, don't be silly, come down. So I said, all right, I'll come down. So I came down, I bought the bottle of wine, and there was this guy there. He's a really good guy called Demo. And he was like running the whole sort of thing. And he said to me, oh, like, you know, and he's from Georgia. A really, really nice bloke from Georgia. And he was like, you know, not part of the yoga thing, but running the built, you know, the whole where we were on the seafront. And he just said, oh, you know, everyone in here has a secret, my friend. Everyone in every room. I was like, fucking no, you're right. And I said, I'm not gonna be one of those. So I kind of like came out and I got the bottle of wine, put it down, just said, right. I'm not drinking anymore. I'm drinking here in front of everyone. So everyone started drinking then and doing whatever they were doing. So it was kind of like, you know, it was good. And then after that, it was a release. It was kind of like I felt very, you know, relieved that, you know, in the mornings you get up, you practice yoga, and then you'd eat, then you do your own thing, you practice yoga at night and all get together. And it's like some really cool people, like from all over the world.
Mm.
Some great musicians there, like really good artists from all over the world. And so, yeah, I met some amazing people and we're still keeping in touch. You know, it seemed to be like a whole load of people from Berlin.
Okay.
I loved it. I've got to say I loved it.
So was it something to kind of open yourself up to more kind of artistic ideas, or was it just a lifestyle thing? Or
no, not really. I think what happened was just after lockdown, you know, I felt very sort of, you know, I had that lockdown period, and then I had this cancer thing, you know.
Oh, right.
I don't actually know about it,
but no, I didn't this, know.
I had this cancer, like cancer of the throat.
Right.
So I got cancer of the throat. So I had to have an operation, major sort of surgery. Bloody so hell. Then I was supposed to go on the road. We were supposed to be playing at Vegas. So it was me and Rat.
Mm.
Scabies was supposed to be going to Vegas and playing with 1,000 Motels. And so we had to put that on hold.
Mm.
And then the, you know, what with the COVID and all that shit coming in. So it was kind of like, I just thought I've got to do something just to, you know, get out of this sort of, you know,
decompress
space,
like.
Of just, yeah, it was like being in the studio all the time and, you know, not being with people is like very odd, you know. So I kind of like needed to be with people, but it was kind of like something different.
Okay.
So it was, you know, they said to me at the end of the ashram, they said, oh, you know, how would you describe your experience here? And I said, well, like being on the road with the band with no sex, no drugs, and no rock and roll.
So all the best parts of touring, right?
Yeah. But I said, you know, it was great. It was good fun. You know?
Oh, excellent. Are you cancer-free now as well?
Yeah, I'm cancer-free now.
Oh, so. Brilliant. Good stuff. Was that recent? Was that in the last year or so?
I had the operation in August last year because, yeah, I mean, basically it was just like I had a cyst on the back of the tongue and, you know, just said it was just a cyst. And then after a while, I went in August for another test and they said, oh, it's cancer. So the guy said to me, oh, you know, you better come in. We've done a test. You better come in. So I came in and he was kind of like, having a panic attack in front of me, you know, it's like sort of.
It's not what you want.
It was sort of, and I said, all right, come on. I know what it is, it's fine. I said, but I've been waiting 2 years to find out because I've been having all these biopsies. So, but I felt sorry for the poor bloke, really, you know, like really sort of quite terrible. And I just said to him, look, it's fine. And I thought, right, okay, at least they know what it is.
Yeah.
I really didn't know what the scale of the operation was going to be because it was like massive, like real sort of like, you know, like major operation for just a little cyst. You just thought they'd just cut it out. But, you know, it was a major operation. So anyway, so I did that. I went in. That was a new experience. I mean, again, I met a whole load of people in the hospital ward who were like really interesting and like, you know, some real funny guys.
Right.
And I couldn't speak because after the operation, they cut a bit of my tongue out.
Sure.
So I couldn't speak. I had like two bottles of blood, like one in each hand, you know, sort of a whole, like my throat, they cut around my whole throat. So it was all kind of like stitched up around there.
Yeah.
And I was kind of like walking around. I said, oh, can you put my leather jacket on, please? And my Mr. Ducktail t-shirt. And they said, I just need to feel a bit more normal. And so with my ass sticking out of the, you know, those things. Yeah. But you know those things you have to wear back to front.
Yeah,
you know, in the hospital. So I was like, I had that. My arse was sticking out the back, but I had the leather jacket on at least, and the Mr. Ducktail t-shirt. So I kind of like must have looked like Frankenstein. But it would have made a great album cover. I really fucking missed that opportunity.
You never got anyone to take a photo for you.
No, my God, it was like such a good photo opportunity. I just thought. Yeah, looking back at it, it must have been like Frankenstein, sort of, you know, Zorba, the Greek version of Frankenstein, you know, trying to escape to get some drink downstairs, you know, somewhere. But it's mad, yeah.
That's brilliant. It sounds like you've got quite a positive outlook on life by the sounds of that.
Well, not much you can do, is there?
You know, or is it just a kind of going with the flow thing, is it?
Well, they were a bit worried because when they told me about that I had cancer, they used all these fancy words for it. And I just said, what, you mean cancer? And then they said, yeah. And I said, okay, fine. So they said, well, we're going to have to get you into this operation. I said, fine. And they said, and I had a friend with me and the friend said, oh, you know, they took my friend outside and said, is he okay? Because he doesn't seem bothered about it. Because they asked me how I'm feeling. I said, I feel great. I said, I feel really good. And they thought, and I thought I was going to get sectioned then, because I thought, I think I'm fucking mad. So then I said, well, I'm a little bit worried. I kind of had to make up, and I thought, right, I have to pretend. And I said, you know, like I was a little bit worried, but I wasn't. And it was kind of like, I think it's just, you know, I don't actually really worry about dying, like, don't worry about what's going to happen in 2 minutes' time or a minute's time. So,
I suppose it's a good way to be, I guess. Then you're never going to die of a heart attack by the sounds of it.
I'm not worried. No.
Oh, that's excellent. We've gone really in deep, very, very early. This is good. I'm enjoying this. But yeah, I suppose the other thing to add right at this juncture is that I've got to thank our mutual friend Rhiannon Iffens setting this up.
She's brilliant.
She is. Yeah. I love Rhiannon. So yeah, I met her at the last part of last year after after joining Tim V's Sham, and just got on like a house on fire. So thank you to her for setting brilliant. This up.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Rhiannon.
How far do you guys go back?
I think I met her. I'm trying to think. I have no idea, to be honest with you. I think, as far as I can remember, maybe the Wolfman days.
Okay, yeah.
But maybe before, I don't know, because I don't remember much about the Adamant days of... I do remember some things, but I'm not sure if I met her during the Adamant days, because she's probably quite a lot younger than me. So I'm not sure if she was sort of around during that period when I was doing that. I have no idea, but I do remember from the Wolfman days for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, cool. And to go back a little bit kind of further, before we kind of get into the career, because I know that there's a lot to cover and I don't think we're going to be able to cover it all. I just wanted to go back. I feel like we've got to know each other quite well, or at least I've got to know you and your kind of outlook. But just for the listeners, I guess, bearing in mind that you've kind of had a career that spans so many different styles and so many different bands and acts and all that, what was the first song that you remember that made you think, I really want to do that and kind of maybe try and make a living out of playing music?
Well, I don't think it was a song so much as it was something like I remember sort of hearing some, I was at school, and I remember hearing some music that was being played live, and I was sort of drawn to it, and it's, you know, sounded like very much like Hendrix, you know, sort of blues type stuff, glammy. And I went into the hall, the music hall, you know, the school music hall, and there was this band playing. And there was long hair and sort of like, you know, all these girls were around, you know, looked amazing. And I thought, fucking hell, this is good. And, you know, I was only like 13 or something. And these were the older guys, and they had all these really good looking girls around.
Yeah.
And they looked like they were having some fun, you know. And then just remember sort of like the whole sort of image of the curly guitar leads and the smell of the amps, you know, the Fender and Marshall amps, and the sort of visual aspect of the, you know, the Gibson, the red, there was like a red SG, I think, or something like that, and then the Fender amp with the, you know, the Fender bass, and it's kind of like, it's quite intoxicating in a kind of like, you know, with the whole image of the girls. And then I kind of was watching them for a while, and they were outside, and then there must have been like, I guess, sixth formers, or, you know, because there was someone with a Jeep. And I remember them just getting all in this Jeep afterwards and all, you know, heading off somewhere, and it looked like they were having fun. I just thought, fuck me, that looks so much better than what I'm doing at 13.
So the older boys all had the guitars and the girls, and that was it.
Yeah, and, you know, I kind of like, in my head, I imagine they were heading off to the beach, you know, for some beers, some good times. And I was like, there's me sort of going through all the teenage troubles and sort of like in my bedroom, sort of listening to T-Rex, Jimi Hendrix, The Faces, Pink Floyd, what, you know, all, you know, early back then, Syd Barrett stuff, a lot of prog, sort of really sort of weird sort of prog rock stuff from Kraut, you know, German sort of, like, I can't remember what they're called, but like acid, a lot of acid sort of, that sort of period from Germany. I'm trying to think what they were called now, but I remember actually meeting one of the guys. I can't tell you the story because it's too rude, but what happened?
Which anything goes.
It was his, I guess they're both dead now, but I don't know. But his wife was there, and we were all kind of like really young. And he said, oh, you have to come round to my flat for a jam. So we went round there, and his wife was there. And we were kind of like all playing and, you know, jamming guitars. And, you know, we kind of like thought, and she started coming around to us all, started playing, and we're going like, what the fuck's going on? You know, it's just like, what was this, some sort of orgy? And we're all kind of, yeah, we're about 13, so we're all a bit sort of like, oh my God, you know, oh, do you want the special wine from under the bed?
Oh my God.
And so she said, he said, get the special wine from under the bed sort of thing. So there's us sort of going, yeah, what is the special wine? Let's have some of that. But I think that was the beginning of the downhill stuff, yeah, from my Latin classes into debauchery.
So that was that one of the guys you said from one of the German bands that you were listening to invited you back to the flat, or was
I think it was like a band called it'll come to me in a minute. I'm trying to think what it was called. I guess if we carry on talking, it will come to me. But they were kind of like one of those very, I think they were sort of 70s German sort of, you know, prog rock sort of bands.
I'm trying communists. To think whether it's like, is it kind of Orange Goblin or something like that? Although they were a bit later, were they? I can't
think. No, this was, it'll come to me in a minute. But they were, it was, you know, interesting period, because I was kind of like, you know, just sort of trying to discover what I liked musically. And I liked glam. I knew I liked glam. I knew I liked Jimi Hendrix. That's what, and getting back to your question, yeah. So the first records, as opposed to sort of visual and sound thing, was like Hendrix.
Right.
I can't remember which album it was, but it was around 67 or 70, 67 to 70, and there was like Hendrix, and there was like a lot of ska music then.
Yeah.
So I was really into ska music and
that kind of first wave, kind of Desmond Dekker and all that.
Amazing. Yeah, Tinks I loved
and the
it.
Maytals. Yeah.
Oh,
because was that when you were, was it Charing Cross that you were born, or was this later on?
Well, I was born in Charing Cross Road. And then I lived actually just, you know, where Denmark Street is. Mm. So I was brought up just around the corner from Denmark Street. So where Centre Point is now,
yeah,
just right opposite.
Okay.
So my dad had a restaurant, so we were brought up above that.
Mm.
And then later on, moved down to Sandringham Flats. And Cat Stevens was my godbrother then. Well, wow. He still is.
Okay.
but he changed his name, didn't he? So it was kind of like odd, because I know his dad was really pissed off with him for converting to, you know, religion. Obviously, he went to Muslim, didn't he?
Yeah, Islam. Yeah.
So... And I know he was begging him to go back to, you know, Greek Orthodox, you know, even on his deathbed. But, so that was interesting. It was an interesting period. No, this was like what happened. So then my parents moved to Plymouth. They got this place in Plymouth, which is like terrible. But I was only like 5 or 6 at the time. So they sent me to school down in Plymouth. So that's why I grew up. Until I was old enough to leave. And then I left as soon as I could drive. So, you know.
Back to London.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Straight back to London. Yeah.
So I can't kind of let you gloss over the fact that Cat Stevens is your godbrother. So were your families were friends, were they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we used to go around there and, it was kind of an odd thing, because they kept on sending me money for years.
Right.
Like, until they died. And I was like thinking, oh, I remember sort of playing with Adam Ant and thinking I'm still getting money from them. And they kept on sending me Christmas money. And like, you know, I was thinking like, this is so odd. But they were so nice, like really nice people.
So and, you weren't related. They were just
not directly. They just sort of like, it's like with the Greeks, they have like, you can be like the godparent without being related. So it's like, you know, if you're one of your closest friends, you point him to be the godfather or the, you know, whatever. So it was, you know, quite an interesting sort of thing. And I don't think I've ever met him since he was famous. So, you know, it's been kind of like, you know, when we were kids.
He's a fair bit older than you, isn't he? I'm just looking now.
Yeah.
48.
Yeah.
So 73 years old. Yeah.
Yeah. So probably, I guess he's 10, about 11 years older. Yeah. So so I'm 64 now. So it's kind of like, so he must be, so he's what, 71?
Yeah, he's 73, apparently, according to Wikipedia, which we know obviously is 100% fact.
I don't know, fuck this. But anyway, it's interesting because I was kind of like looking at Greek Orthodox stuff today. I was looking back to, I got very interested in this whole monasteries and Greek thing when I went to Mount Athos and ended up sort of thinking about becoming a monk at some point.
Right.
And I went to Mount Athos and, you know, I was looking at all this stuff today. I was thinking like, fucking hell, you know, how can you go from being in a rock and roll band, you know, having sex like all day, drinking, and then going to a monastery? It's like, you know, I guess, you know, I have no idea.
Was the excess driving you towards something more of a quiet life, perhaps?
Maybe. I mean, I do feel that at the end of that period with Adam Ant, I was sort of like thinking, oh, I've had enough of it. And it was like, looking back on it, it was, I think, like, how could you have had enough of it? But, you know.
it's funny how your perspective shifts over time, isn't it?
It's weird, isn't it? It is weird, yeah. It was like, sort of, obviously, it was like you couldn't get life to be any better.
Because before Adamant, you were playing in like blues bands and stuff like that, right? I mean, what did you start playing? Did you start playing the piano, the guitar, or the bass? Where did you start?
So I started off playing. I went to the, you know, when I saw that band playing, I went and I said, "Oh, I want to play music. Want to play music?" And they said, "Oh, we've only got, you know, what have we got left," and they only had a flute left. So I said, "Well, I want to play like Jimi Hendrix. I want to play fucking flute. I want to play like, you know." And they said, "Oh no, you'll have to play." So I went in, and like there was this guy in there. They gave me his flute. So I started playing flute, and he couldn't even play flute. He played clarinet or something. Yeah. So the teacher was like going, "I said, oh, this is bollocks." So I kind of like stuck with it for a bit, and then I said, "No, I want to play guitar." And then he said, "Oh, I can teach you how to play guitar as well," but he couldn't play guitar. So then he said, so I got a guitar. He gave me a guitar. It was like, he said, he taught me how to play Edelweiss.
Right.
And like, you know, just a single note. And I said, "I want to play fucking Jimi Hendrix." And so it didn't go anywhere. So those lessons didn't go anywhere. And I kind of like thought, I've got to get my own band together. And so, you know, it started where everyone else's band starts, I guess, in your mum's kitchen.
Yeah.
Or the garage. But I think we progressed to the garage.
Chucked out of the kitchen into the garage.
Yeah. But we started in the kitchen, and my mate came up and he had some guitars, and there was only like a bass left. So he said, "I want you to play the bass." So I got on the bass, and we were doing Status Quo songs and Beatles stuff, and yeah, it's pre-punk, so it was kind of like all that stuff, and I was playing till my fingers were bleeding. I got so obsessed. Yeah. So that was the beginning, really.
Okay. And some of your early bands, I mean, it says on Wikipedia, which again I say is the font of all knowledge, that some of your earlier bands kind of went on to kind of support acts like King Crimson. Is that true, or is that made
up? Yeah, no, we did actually. I do remember, because when they used to come down to Plymouth and play, I think there were bands like that and Hawkwind that were coming down, and we just used to be able to get in on supporting them. So we just go and support them. Mm. And there was quite a sort of good music scene down there. So not a good music scene, but, you know, we could get in, and it was so bad that they'd get us on stage. They'd nowhere else to choose. So we'd end up supporting whoever came into town. So,
but that's a great opportunity though, isn't it? Because like bands like that, did you kind of get like, was it kind of inspiring to see acts like that?
Oh my God, yeah. Yeah, really inspiring. Like, I mean, Hawkwind, like, with Stacey with her tits out and everything. It was like, sort of like, for us, like little kids, it was like, oh my God, look, she's got her tits out. She's shaking around. Oh my, and there's a strobe going. It's like, you know, you kind of like, we were like real idiots. It was like 13-year-old sort of, you know.
Yeah, but to a 13-year-old, that's like utter rock and roll excess, all the strobes lighting's going off, topless women everywhere.
Yeah, no, it was great. It was like really, it was, yeah. And then King Crimson, said my friend's still drumming with them.
Oh, really?
Well, not still, he wasn't the drummer then, but
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. But he's gone on to drum with them. Wow.
Yeah, Jeremy Stacey. So, yeah, I mean, all that period was sort of, you know, soon, it wasn't that good, but it was kind of like being a teenager. It was better than wanking off in your bedroom sort of thing. You know, it was a bit of a...
Well, it's real life experience, isn't it? It's getting out there and seeing it. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I don't say anymore, but yeah. You can edit all this stuff, can't you? So,
yeah. I can edit what you want.
No, I don't mind you using all that. I mean, I haven't said things can get this controversial, so...
No, I love this. This is candid, you know. And then you play in as a bass player in Diz Watson's blues band, was that?
Oh, yeah.
Because the only reason that I say that, I think there's a little bit of circularity recently with, was it The Mutants or was it 1000 Motels, where you eventually kind of came full circle and worked with Diz again?
Yeah, we got him in on a couple of tracks, because that Mutants one that we did was supposed to be done in Memphis, but COVID hit in, so we had to do it like all, you know, via digital. But we did, so I got Dizon on piano, and actually Diz just sent me a text. He'd had another heart attack.
Oh, wow.
I think he's had like three. I'm not laughing because he's had a heart attack, but it is sort of funny because like we meet up and we go, oh, this may be the last time, Chris. And he goes like, you know, but he's so funny because he's like from Yorkshire.
Right.
And he's from Ilkley.
Right, yeah.
Do you know where that is?
So he's quite straight talking, straightforward.
Yeah.
I've got family from up that way. So, yeah, I know exactly the kind of people you're talking about.
He's kind of like got a sort of, because he plays all this sort of New Orleans stuff, got this sort of New Orleans draw, but a northern sort of accent as well. But I love this. So I learned a lot playing with him, and because I started off playing with him after the sort of prog rock and all that shit, with playing in those bands. I started playing in with Diz, and then I joined the punk thing. Never saw him until it all came around recently.
Yeah, that's a great bit of circularity, I think. You know, it's interesting how these things happen sometimes in life.
Yeah.
So when were you asked to join Adam's band anyway? Like, what? How did that kind of come about?
Well, I think it was, I think what happened was, I was playing with this band called Drill, and we were signed to RCA Records, Ebony Records first, which was, the adverts were signed to them.
Yeah.
And Fleetwood Mac. I have no idea. That's weird. The Drill, Fleetwood Mac, and, you know, the advert. So, and what was interesting was, because we played, when I played with the Wolfman at the 100, I'll come back to the cushion, but when we played at the 100 Club with the Wolfman, Tim, is it from TV Smith, and Gay Advert, and all the people, like the guy from the publishing company, the record company from the Drill, the advert stays, Fleetwood Mac, everyone was in the audience. Tony Visconti, everyone from my whole sort of career. And it was such a weird thing. And I was looking at it going, how is this possible? Like, has God fixed this gig up just as your last gig? And I was thinking, like, you know, is this your last gig? It's like, you know, it was looking into the audience.
Almost like seeing your life flash before your eyes in the audience.
It was really, really odd.
Because the 100 Club's not a big place either, is it? You know, so
no, and that's and Rhiannon was actually selling some merch there for us. I remember that. So yeah, I'm thinking like yeah. So back to the question, which was well, I can't remember now. Where did we get
like how did you end up playing in Adam Ant's band? Like, what was process? Who approached you? And you know,
yeah, that was. So basically what happened was playing that band Drill, and we'd sort of been through, we'd released a load of stuff, you know, with Chaz Chandler, we'd been on supporting Slade, and I think the guitarist joins Dire Straits. So I thought, oh, fuck, you know, yeah, he's joined, the whole band is sort of falling to bits now. So I thought, well, I better do something. And then I looked in the NME or the Melody Maker, and there was an advert. Bass player wanted, must be able to stand and deliver, you know.
Nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
Yeah, so it was pretty obvious, you know. So I called up and, you know, I felt like I was, although it was my band, I felt like I was cheating on the band sort of thing, you know, because, you know. So I kind of like phoned them up and they said, oh, we're not seeing any more bass players. You know, we've had enough. So they couldn't find anyone. So then I got a friend of mine who worked for the original company that we signed to, that the adverts were signed to, who then worked for CBS to get me an audition. So she put in a word for me and I got an audition at Nomis Studios.
Yeah.
So basically, yeah, I got an audition and they said, you know, just turn up. I remember, I think I was married at the time. Yeah, I was married to someone called Julie. Hello, Julie. no, me and Julie are still friends, but
she'll be listening.
But anyway, so I think I said to her, oh yeah, you know, got an audition for this band, you know, I said, right, I'm going to go for it. So I remember sort of like listening to the whole of Adam and the Ants back catalogue, which was Dirt Wiz, White Sox, Kings of the Wild Frontier, and Prince Charming. And I thought, right, I'll learn all of that. So I learned it all the backing vocals and everything. And I kind of knew it was going to get the job. I was determined to get it. So kind of practiced everything and, you know, went running, just completely clean for 2 weeks. Mm. Went to the audition at Nomis, you know, Sinclair Road. Walked in. The roadie called Stuart, who I got to know afterwards, you know, sort of said, come in. All right. You know, I'd sort of had my bass. He just said, no, you don't need that. So he tuned up this bass for me and gave a bass to me. I thought, and it was just like a spotlight there in the studio, and there was a spotlight on me, and
right.
It was just Adam and Marco were kind of like sitting on this sort of stage above me.
Yeah,
you know, I was thinking, what the fuck is this?
And
I was dressed in a pink suit with floppy hair and the whole, you know, sort of. I said, "Well, do you want me to play?" And they said, "Well," I said, "I thought I was going to play with you guys," and they said, "No, can you just play some jazz?"
Okay, right.
Can you play some blues? Can you play some punk? Can you just play some rock? So I kind of thought, well, this is just a joke sort of thing. I was kind of, yeah, you know. And then Marco was just scribbling on a bit of paper. He looked like he was really bored, which he probably was. And I think he was just writing cunt or something like that. And then I could see that Adam was interested, so... Adam was just asking me all these questions, and I said, look, you know, okay, fine, is that it? So he said, yeah. So I sort of said, well, I'm going there. So I left, and I was walking out the door, and as I was walking out the door, he was following me, asking me, when can you meet up? When can you blah, 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 blah. He was like, really, I thought, all right, calm down, sort of thing. Hmm. You know, it's kind of like, it was very obvious that he was interested.
Yeah.
But I didn't know why until later. It was obviously wasn't because of my bass player, don't you? But I realized because he liked Robert De Niro, and I think I looked a bit like Robert De Niro then. Because I had the shaved hair, and it was all, you know, it's like kind of like, well, I was very thin. I remember being very thin. And he said, oh, you look like Robert De Niro, you know, and sort of. And but anyway, so that's how it happened. And then I got a phone call. And Judy said, oh, Adam's on the phone. I said, I'll tell him to fuck off. And I thought it was my friend Adam.
Not that Adam.
Yeah. And so I went on the phone. He said, oh, it's Adam Ant. Do you want to come on the world tour? And I said, I said, yeah. And he said, can you meet me in Tootsie's at Holland Park tomorrow for breakfast? So I said, yeah. So I met him there. I was very nervous. And he was sort of saying, well, okay, we're going to give you some money now. So his manager turned up.
Yeah.
And they gave me a load of cash. And then they said, what's your bank account details? And we'll put some money in. And okay. That was it. That was the beginning of it. Yeah.
So an advance even before setting off. That's not bad. That's trusting.
Yeah.
So how long between that initial tryout and then going on tour?
Not long at all. I looked at my diaries because I'm writing a book. So I was kind of like, I think, you know, within a short period of time, we were still our first gig at the Astoria for Fans. And then we did, like, I went to America, played in America. And, you know, it was like real, like, non-stop gigging and playing and everything. And, yeah, no, it was quick.
And because you played on the Strip and Viva La Rock albums, right?
I didn't know. On the Strip album, what happened was I was at my mum's for Christmas, and I got a phone call from the manager saying, oh, will you go to Sweden and play on this album? And I said, not really. No, I said, I'm with my mum. I said, it's Christmas. And so they said, they were a bit pissed off, you know. And then I said to Bob, do you want to go? So Bob spoke to the manager, and, you know, we both said, look, you know, it's a bit short notice. It was kind of like Christmas Eve or something. I can't remember. But it was like, you know, you're with your family, and kind of like, I just didn't want to do it.
You settled in, yeah.
Well, I did want to do it, but then in retrospect, I'm glad I didn't do it because I didn't like that album. And, you know, when I listened to it, I thought, there must be one track on there must like. I can't remember it that well, but I do remember live, it was a struggle to play.
Right.
Yeah, it was, like, really hard to play that album. It was, like, very sort of depressing to play live, that album.
Really? Okay. Because yeah. That's the one with, that's got Puss in Boots and Strip with the two singles,
yeah.
Isn't it? And
yeah.
Then you've got Baby Let Me Scream at You, Libertine, Spanish Games, Playboy.
Puss in Boots was one of the first Top of the Pops I did, because I think it was a four piece. So the first, they said to us, oh, we're doing Top of the Pops.
Mm.
And so we did Puss in Boots. I remember they bought me all these Lewis leathers. So, and that's when I shaved my hair. And I did I started cutting my own hair and it went wrong. So I ended up shaving it all off. And then he said, oh, we got Top of the Pops tomorrow. So I said, oh, fine. So I took my hat off and said, well, I'm bald. And it was, that was it. So I got no hair.
Did that go down very well? Because I know Adam used to be at least quite
thin on the top.
Well said. That, and also no. Quite stringent about how people looked and how they dressed.
Well, yeah, he liked it because it was kind of like I looked like when in the Deer Hunter, I think it was, or when Robert De Niro shaved his head. Oh, Taxi Driver, that was it. So yeah. He said, oh, you like De Niro and Taxi Driver, that's cool. So
he rechristened you Chris De Niro, didn't he, basically?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was it. So it was kind of like, and then he put up, you know, we went to Lewis Leathers, I had all this stuff, and then he wrote on my jacket, Chris De Niro, which Michelle Collins has now.
Okay.
I've asked her many times for the jacket back, had no reply. And because she stayed over at my place one night and nothing happened. We were mates from, we all used to hang out in this pub called The Old Red Lion in Islington, where there was a lot of Kathy Burke and Ray Winston. All before they were famous sort of thing, they were hanging out there and I lived down the road. So we used to go in there and she came around one night, so she was a bit cold. So I think she ended up, or maybe she just nicked my jacket. I have no idea, but and me being such a nice bloke. So I have contacted her recently because we've got some mutual friends.
Yeah.
And said I'd like my jacket back. But she's probably fucking lost it or sold it or something. But that Adamant thing, that first Puss in Boots thing, if you look at it, it's hilarious. It's like so funny, that whole sort of like Top of the Pops thing.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I think you might be the second guest I've had on who's done Top of the Pops. How is that to actually do? Because I get the impression that it's not quite as glamorous as it seems for those of us watching at home.
No, it's not glamorous. It's like really, like, I don't know. It's like, you know, it's just like being in like Alan Partridge in the back of the BBC somewhere. And, you know, the only thing that was funny was there used to be like, because there were a lot of funny artists around then, you know, that period when we were doing Total Pops, they'd all be running down the corridors and, you know, like making jokes and like there'd be kind of like a bit of an atmosphere because of the bands. But we were in kind of like horrible rooms, you know, with a fridge that was warm with, you know, a kind of lager, Heineken lager in and some dried up cheese from 2 years ago or something. It was not glamorous.
No. And I hear that the production staff were a little bit kind of, they're not the friendliest bunch, or they don't put up with a lot of stuff from the acts.
No, you couldn't do anything. I remember just like it was really boring. And one of the best ones we did was when we did Apollo 9. And we'd been in Torquay at a CBS convention the night before. So he sent us a limo and we went down to Torquay. And it was like the whole of, there was Wham and everyone was there. I've got this great photograph of us all in Torquay. And they said, oh, you know, you've got to drive back and do Top of the Pops next day. So we stopped at Hamling's, you know, the toy shop, and we got all these toys. and he put them in, he painted the bass drum, and we put them all in front of the kit. And I thought that Top of the Pops was fun. It was like kind of creative, and otherwise it's fucking boring.
And I suppose the other thing as well, you're the first person who's done Live Aid as well.
Oh, right.
Like, I've not talked to anyone who was involved in that day. So, like, I mean, how the hell was that to kind of go on, what, after the Boomtown Rats and before Ultravox on Wembley Stadium?
I have no idea. did we go on after the Boomtown Rats? I can't remember.
I've had a look through the kind of lineup, and it was Boomtown Rats, Adamant, and then Ultravox was the lineup. But
I'm trying to think, because I remember there was the guy from the Jam.
Mm.
Their band, what were they were called? Style Council.
Oh, Style Council. Yeah, yeah.
And I'm trying to think. So yeah. So well, I just got told that we were doing a charity gig.
Right.
That was it.
Which I suppose it was, but it was like the charity gig.
Yeah. And being the sort of person I am, which is nothing impresses me that much. Well, it does, but maybe things that shouldn't impress me. But I thought a charity gig, okay, fine. And I said, oh, we're getting paid for it. And, you know, they said no. And I thought, okay, fine. So I think we were getting paid on a retainer anyway. So it was kind of like, so charity gig, okay, fine. They said, oh, it's at Wembley. So I said, okay, Wembley, fine. So turned up at Wembley. It was the stadium. And I wasn't that impressed then. I was kind of like thinking, okay, at Wembley Stadium. It was the night before because we did the sound check. I think it was Status Quo. So all the bands that were on first did a sound check.
Mm.
And then we stood in the hotel because you wouldn't be able to get there in the morning because of the people that were there. So we got there, we did a sound check. Sound check was, you know, it's okay. It was one of those, you know, better than some of the sound checks I've done. So I thought, it's all right. And then there was some sort of political stuff going on between Adam and Bob Geldof, and I don't know, I'm just the bass player sort of thing. I was thinking, like, I don't want to know anything about this sort of stuff. And they said we were going to do four songs, and then it was just one, I think. Oh, no, then two, then one. I said, whatever, one's better than nothing. So we ended up playing Viva Rock, and it was like sort of, because that was the single at the time, it was highly criticised that we weren't, you know. And I remember sort of saying, thinking, maybe I didn't say it, but I remember thinking, well, if we've only got one song, we should play Ant Music or Goody Two Shoes or something, you know, like that people know.
Rather than the brand new single.
Yeah. And it just didn't feel right. And it didn't, even though, you know, it's a great song the way it was recorded.
Mm.
But yeah.
Well, that was the thing. I mean, it was recorded by Tony Visconti, wasn't it? And I mean, he's an absolute legend. So how was it working for him? How was that process? Because he's got a very specific style, hasn't he?
Yeah, he was very strict back then, because I worked with him since. But back then he was like into this Scientology thing.
Okay, right. I didn't realise that.
Yeah, he was in that group, Est, I think they were called.
Mm.
And it was like very strict. So it was like 11 o'clock to 7 o'clock, and then the break from 1 o'clock till 2 o'clock. And Adam turned up late on the first day and, you know, got bullocked. And he was sort of, I think he turned up at 7 minutes past 11. And
that was late enough.
He was pulled into a room and, you know, we had all the shouting going on. And, you know, Tony bollocking him, just saying, you know, this won't do. And, you know, we're trying to run a tight ship. You know, it's kind of like, I guess, trying to set the rules sort of thing. And Adam came out white-faced and just sort of like, you know, more white-faced than he was. And he was kind of like, you know, fuck. So, but he was very strict and, you know, very, you know, it was very quick. The whole process was just like, you know, we whacked our stuff down.
Mm.
But he was very strict. You know, come 7 o'clock at night, he was on his BMW, suitcase shut on his BMW bike, going home. And, you know, we put everything down really quickly. So, you know, I love Tony. I thought he was great.
Oh, brilliant. And you managed to kind of survive at least one slimming down of Adamant's solo band.
I like that.
I use the term politically. What do you think that it was that maybe you, what he saw in you that he liked to keep you around? Because he's quite mercenary about the people that he...
That's quite a good question. That's the first time I got asked that question. Yeah? And strangely enough, it's kind of a really good one, actually, because that is exactly what I would call it, is slimming down. And I remember thinking, it's coming. And I thought, you know, it's like being in a sort of a mafia gang, and you know that some of you are going to get taken out. And it was kind of like, who's going? And we were all sort of like, you know, close and everything, but I just thought, and he pulled me aside one night, and I wish he hadn't, actually, because we were still on tour. And, you know, he said to me, look, you know, I'm going to be slimming things down. Maybe he didn't use that word, but, you know, that's what the thing was. And he said, you're staying.
Okay.
And going to put you on a retainer, and it's going to be more like a band, and blah, 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 blah. And I felt so bad, you know, because I felt guilty. Like, you know, for the rest of the guys, I felt terrible for them. And I felt like, you know, it's just a burden to carry.
So was it that, like, do you think that he... Did you have a better relationship with him than some of the other guys? Did you kind of, or did you engineer it that way, perhaps, because you knew it was coming?
I don't think so, because I was so naive, you know, kind of like very naive. But I think that he was just thinking he wanted it to be more like a get back to punk days. Like, you know, he was like, he really liked the Clash. Like Sex Pistols, and he wanted it to be more like that. So, you know, he wanted to strip it right back. And so that was his thinking. You know, and me and him, obviously, we got on very well. It was just me and him hanging out most nights. You know, just we were both into the same thing. So it was kind of like mainly women, but it was like, you know, and... I don't think any of the other, you know, Marco wasn't into women and stuff, you know. Not that he's into men, but he wasn't, you know.
He wasn't chasing.
He wasn't like me and Adam. No, we were completely like, you know. So it was like sort of most nights it was, you know, just me and him sort of on duty. And so Marco was out being arty, or you know, his arty friends at somewhere. And everyone else was doing other stuff, and we would be out, me and Adam, doing what we did. I mean, it sounds terrible, doesn't it, to say it? I mean, I feel like it's such a fucking wanker saying it, but we were pretty sort of, you know, that's how it was, you know.
Yeah, well, this is it. I mean, it's the 80s, it's the excess era. It's being in a band, it's being in a successful band, you know. It's part and parcel of why a lot of people have got into rock and roll music for decades and decades, isn't it? You know?
Yeah.
So it slimmed down to you, Adam, Marco and Bogdan, wasn't it, on drums?
Yeah, Bob, yeah.
And you went on from there. But, I mean, it didn't last too much further after the kind of Viva La Rock era, did it? Kind of 1985 into 1986, or was it 87 when it kind of...
I have no idea, but it was kind of like we did... I know that... We were kind of like really doing well in America. And we spent all our time in America touring. And then over here, nothing was really happening. And I think that what went wrong was the focus was taken out of playing England.
Yeah.
And we just focused on America. So we were playing America like 6 months of the year. And I think that the English sort of scene was neglected for too long. Maybe I have no idea of the financials, but it could have been financial. It could have been because Goody Two Shoes was number one in America, and maybe they just thought we'd milk it. You know, I didn't know anything about the business side of what was going on, really. But yeah, I mean, you could see it was all coming to an end. Adam was getting into acting. I was kind of like getting a little bit bored with it all, and we were on the last tour of America. And I said to the tour manager, look, I've had enough, you know. So he said, oh, we're going to go to Tokyo in January. And, you know, I just said, I can't do it. I said, you know, my heart's not in it anymore. And I said, really, Adam is my best friend and he's given me so many breaks, you know, I can't fake it. You know, so I just said, you know, you're going to have to find, I'll stay on until you find someone else.
Right. And so spending as much time as you did with Adam, I mean, was it clear also that he was maybe falling out of love with music as well and obviously wanting to channel more time into the acting?
I'm not sure, really. I mean, I just remember feeling like I didn't know much about his depression or much about. I'd never seen, you know, that until later on, you know, when it happened full on, because I was helping him out when he had the bipolar sessions.
Right.
You know, he called me up and I ended up going into the, you know, the places where he was sectioned to help him out. But I didn't know that that was a big part of what was going on. But I think that looking back on it now, I think that on that last tour, it was kicking in.
Yeah.
So I think the depression had started kicking in. And there was something about it. And I just thought, this is, you know, this just felt doomed. Like, there's something about it, you know.
Just a feeling of like, something's up.
Yeah, and well, I know it was more than that. I mean, I could see there was things happening, and I was kind of like, you know, obviously, you know, you're together, you're a gang, and you're kind of like, you're protective to each other. So when things happen, you support each other. But it was slightly more than that. There was some things happening that you couldn't quite put your finger on, and it just didn't quite feel right, you know. And I certainly didn't feel like, you know, I felt like, you know, I kind of lost my passion for doing it. So, you know, that's why I gracefully, you know, said, you know, I think it was great. And I said to the tour manager, look, you know, I'll do whatever until you find another bass player. I'll help you find another bass player, you know. But then I think Adam just went into acting. So it was kind of like quite a good timing.
Yeah.
And then when Adam got sectioned, he wanted to get a new band together with me called Uber something or other.
Okay.
And then it was all got very odd then, but that's a different thing, you know.
Are you still in contact with him?
No, last time I saw him was at, in Soho, and he was playing. I was just walking through Soho and I kind of heard someone playing Prince Charming, you know, like, and I thought, fuck me, who's that? And so I walked through and it was Adam. And he was just in, you know, we used to go to Bar Italia a lot.
Yeah.
So it was in front of Bar Italia on a little stage with some musicians just playing Prince Charming.
Right.
And there was a sort of Soho festival. So we ended up going inside Bar Italia, having some drinks, a little party. And then his manager came up to me and said, oh, you know, Adam's asked me if you'll play with him again. And I said, yeah, why not, sort of thing, you know. When we sort of talked about it, I never heard anything more. So it was kind of like one of those things. You know, I thought, oh, maybe we're going to get back together and we'll play some stuff. I'd love to do it. You know, I'd love to get back and do something. You know, but that didn't happen. So it wasn't like, you know, a big thing. It was just, I thought that would be fun because I'd get on with Adam.
Yeah, because I suppose in the meantime, you'd kind of gone off and you did a stint with Annabella Lewin from Bow Wow Wow, didn't you? And you worked with her on a couple of bits and through that worked with people like Guy Chambers. Is that right?
Yeah, so basically I got together with Annabella. Me and Bob, who played with Adam Ant on the drums, we wrote all this stuff and I think we've got like 100 songs we wrote like with her that haven't been released. But then got an album that's been released with her and some other stuff that she released. I didn't know she released, but I found it on Spotify. I went on Spotify. Oh, she's released it. Okay, fine. But it was stuff we did in Bob's bedroom.
Oh, wow. Okay. Because I know that she'd released a few singles and I think, did she release a whole album a few years back or something, wasn't it?
Yeah. So, you know, she was really interesting. So she was, we did quite a lot with her. And then we worked with Guy Chambers, and it was when Guy was kind of like, I don't know, Guy had just come out of another band. I can't remember what they were called, but he was trying to get into production, and then he produced us up. We became friends. And then he said to me he was going to give up music. And then, I remember being in his flat in Highgate. And I said, oh, no. So we had a bottle of wine and we were just sitting there just sort of drinking this red wine. I said to him, he said, oh, I think I'm going to teach piano. I said, no. I said, it's too soon to give up. I said, you've got to keep going. And then he got the fucking cut. He got the Robbie Williams gig.
I was going to say, like, imagine him not going on to, like, write all those, like, because those songs that he wrote with Robbie.
Oh, my God. I mean, yeah,
you'd give your right arm to write something like that, wouldn't you? I mean,
yeah,
especially stuff definitely. Like Angels. I mean, think how much, like, how many times that's been played over the years, you know, how many sales.
The
that's
chemistry,
been.
Yeah, amazing.
Mm. Was it obvious back then to you? Was that why you were kind of talking him out of giving up music then? You could see, or was it just like, no, you're too, you should keep on?
I think it was just that you should keep on. I don't think it was like there was nothing obvious about that. Mm. Like, you know, it was just like, you know, he was talented, but it wasn't like, oh, I know you're going to be fucking like super. It was just like, yeah, you haven't even fucking tried yet. You fucking wimp.
And look what happened after that, right? He went on to rule the world.
Yeah, he owes me a drink, doesn't he?
I think he does, yeah.
Yeah.
And then after that, it seemed to me like you went through a little bit of a phase of starting your own bands, like Jackie on Acid and then the Wolfmen with Marco again.
Yeah.
Was that kind of more fulfilling for you to kind of do your own thing after so long of being in, say, like Adam's band and then playing some stuff with Annabella, who maybe would have been more of the focus of those acts? Or was it just that you just wanted to do more stuff? Was it as simple as that?
I think what happened was that Jackie and Acid period was the Monastery periods where I was kind of like a little bit lost and thinking, oh, I don't know what I want to do. And then I thought, I just started writing and ended up sort of doing all this stuff and singing because, you know, it was like I've been singing with Adam for a long time. I thought I knew I had a voice that could cover it, but then trying to find my own voice was something different than finding a voice that you have as a backing vocalist.
Yeah,
for a band, because what happens, as you probably know, is like if you play with a band, you develop the tone of the singer that you're doing all the backing vocals for.
Yeah, because you're either trying to match or harmonise with someone else, aren't you? Yeah.
So I ended up sort of, everyone saying, oh, why have you got that bubble in your voice? You know, that sort of, that Adam, man, you know, can you get rid of that? I was thinking, yeah, I'll try. But it was quite hard. So really, the Jackie and Acid period wasn't through wanting to be a focal point. It was just through necessity.
Mm.
There was, you know, just a way of expressing stuff. So it's kind of, you know, just writing and expressing the stuff. And to be honest with you, I feel more at home being part of a group, not the frontman, actually. So I feel more at home being supportive to a frontman, actually. So the Wolfman was kind of like an interesting period because it was a lot of commitment to just be the frontman and to play the bass and play all the guitar. Yeah, it's like a lot of stuff.
Mm.
So yeah, does that answer your question? I'm
not sure. No, does. I think so. It's not necessarily like but was it nice to kind of have your own thing, you know, that you've come up with yourself rather than kind of joining an established act, I suppose?
Yeah, I think it was. Like things like with Sinead O'Connor when I did the Jack, Is It My Birthday? That song I knew was a good song, but then when she sang on it, it was like, fuck me, she's great. And then Courtney Taylor from Daddy Warhols produced it, and it was like, this is like magical. It was just like, that was amazing. So that was good. And so things like that, certain songs, but then when I go through the catalogue now, I think like some of them are rubbish and, you know, some of them are okay. But, you know, it's not kind of like, it doesn't mean I won't do it again. You know, I still with 1,000 Motels, I do it, you know, but it's just, I don't think I'm a natural front man in the sense that I want to do it. It's not like it's out of necessity sometimes.
You prefer to be a collaborative part of a, you know, a whole. Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. I totally understand that.
Yeah.
Because you also studied on the Slits, Revenge of the Killer Slits EP as well, right?
Yeah, that was interesting, yeah.
I can imagine, yeah. Because, I mean, Ari was a character.
Mm.
I've done a documentary on them as well, and I find...
Really?
I find, yeah, yeah.
Oh, wow.
It's, I find them like a massively underrated band, really. I think they're brilliant. And because on that, was it Paul Cook was doing the drums, wasn't he?
Yeah, I got roped into it through I said roped in because they didn't quite tell me what was going on. So I kind of like, because I knew how to work Pro Tools.
Right.
The only one that knew how to work Pro Tools. So it was kind of like, oh, Chris, can you do this? We'll make you the producer and we'll do this and we'll do that. I thought, okay. And I thought, I was kind of doing a lot of that. So the Slits, I kind of didn't know much about it, but I liked her.
Mm.
And I liked the bass player that didn't play the bass at the time. Because
I was going to say, because Tessa was kind of in the band, but she didn't play on it, right?
I ended up playing because she hadn't practiced for a while.
Yeah.
And so I said, oh, don't worry, I'll play it, because she didn't feel confident enough.
Mm.
So I ended up playing the bass on, I can't remember what it was, there four songs or on that EP?
It would have been about four or five, yeah.
Yeah, so I ended up playing, I remember sort of producing and mixing them and saying I would get a credit, and then I thought, fuck me, I haven't even got a credit. And then, let alone getting paid for it. And then I checked with, I think it was Cargo Records, and they said to me, oh, you know, if you look on the EP, you have got a credit. I said, okay, fine. But, you know, it was kind of like, well, it doesn't matter anything now. It doesn't bother me now. But, you know, it was kind of like, getting back to the experience,
yeah.
I loved working with her. I mean, she was amazing, and I don't think I'd met her before.
Right.
And is it Ari? Isn't it Ari?
Ari, yeah, yeah.
Such a, like, I remember just running around the studio just going like, oh, I've got to get my energy up before I sing. And she was like, so sort of like a little kid.
Yeah. Yeah. She strikes me as someone who was always full of absolutely exuding energy all the time. Oh, you know?
Amazing. A brilliant person. I loved her. Yeah. So for me, and also the bass player, Tess, she was great as well. And, you know, she was, I've been in a place where she's in, we're not practicing. You know, I just said, oh, I'll play it and you can take the credit. So, yeah, I have no fucking, like, I have no issues over what happened on that. I'm just proud to have been part of it, really. So, you know, it's cool.
Because I think that, as well, Tessa was asked by Polystyrene to be on her solo album just before she passed away as well. And again, really? Tessa turned it down. Because she was like, oh, I think she wants someone who's a bit better than I am. She seemed to kind of, maybe she had a bit of a, like she didn't rate herself, you know?
Yeah, she was really good and, you know, really good. But I know what it's like. It's when you're out of practice, you sometimes think, you know, I mean, you know what it's like. It's, if you're out of practice, you don't feel you can do it. So it's like, just being honest about it and stuff. So, but that's funny you mentioned Polystyrene, because back in the drill days, we needed a guitarist and we had Jack Airport.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. Was that after they split up the first time?
Yeah.
Around? Okay.
And that's the funny story about this is he lived in Fulham at the time and did you ever meet him?
No, I never did.
Funny guy, and he was like really sort of, you know, so anyway, so we were sort of all rehearsing, you know, like we used to sort of share a bag of chips and
right.
a bottle of cider after the rehearsal sort of thing. But Jack had a credit card because he'd been X-ray specs.
Okay.
So, so he'd be walking down the road and go, oh, Jack, can you get your credit card out? He goes, well, I don't know if it will still work. because it's from the X-ray specs credit card. I said, go on, give it a go. So we kind of like in Fulham somewhere, and they're like, come on. So he put it in the machine and go, fuck me, it still works. So you get 100 quid out, and we'd be off for the night. So
brilliant.
Yeah, Jack Airport. I think he's dead now, but, you know, God bless his soul. You know, Jack was great. And he worked at, you know, he worked in a travel agent. That's why they call him Jack Airport.
That's right. Yeah. Oh, brilliant. I had no idea about that little
crossover. I forgot about it. Yeah, Jack. And polystyrene was, because I was friends with Hazel O'Connor, so they were both out with the Hare Krishnas.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever been there, out to that place.
No, I haven't. No, but I know there were a few people. I suppose maybe that kind of fed into your monastery thing as well.
Well, I saw them yesterday. I was in Soho yesterday, and I was like, they were all sort of outside playing the drums and singing. I had a good old laugh thinking about it, but it was funny. Yeah, it's funny. I loved all that. Polystyrene, I thought, was brilliant.
Yeah, 100%. Like a total one-off.
Warrior of Woolworths, and do you remember? I mean, you know, amazing stuff.
Yeah, they're so great. That first album is just incredible. Like the lyricism, the fact that all of the lyrics, you can kind of pick them apart and they're still relevant now, you know, like the plastic society that we live in.
Yeah. And
gender and racial inequality and that kind of thing. It's all still so relevant.
Yeah.
Such a loss. It's amazing to think what she would have been doing now, you know.
So with are you playing there?
I play bass in Tim V's Sham 69.
What is Sham 69 now? What are they playing?
It's a difficult situation. I'm going to have to cut all this out.
Okay. All right.
I've only been with them about a year. And obviously we haven't had that many gigs in the last year.
Is it still like a lot of skinheads go to it?
It's not too,
as bad as it was.
Yeah.
Must be difficult. Because I know talking to Rat Scabies, you know, who I play with, he says, you know, they used to get a lot of trouble at their gigs.
Yeah.
Damned. But, you know, I played with a few bands that have had, like, you know, a lot of skinhead followings.
Mm.
It's quite difficult to get rid of them, or quite difficult to disassociate in a kind of friendly way.
The thing is, you've got to be confrontational, haven't you? Because I know Madness had the same thing, didn't they, where they had to
Buster Blood Vessel.
And talking about Rat Scabies as well, I mean, he was in the Mutants as well, right, later on, when you formed that band. And that, again, that's a band that's been going since about 2000.
Yeah, we saw Rats. I met Rat in we're doing the first album with Wilco Johnson. I got in Wilco Johnson, Wayne Kramer, Neville Staples. And those who the reason why Wilco started was because he saw Wayne Kramer playing. So it was just one of those chance things.
Yeah.
That Wayne Kramer was over, and I just sort of said, you know, everything just slotted into place. It was, you know, we ended up there, and it was just then I said, okay, even though I play the bass, I said, let's get Norman Watroy down.
Oh, wow. For the track. Yeah.
Because he's my favourite bass player.
He's incredible. Right. I saw the Blockheads a couple of times, and his playing is just mad.
It's off the scale, isn't it? It's just like, so he came down, so the whole thing turns into a party, and Wilco, he thought he was going to die of cancer at the time from whatever. So he was kind of like, we were drinking pints of gin and tonic, and Wayne is completely clean, and it must have been odd for him, but I've got a whole footage of the day. Rat was, and that's where I met Rat. And it was like, it was brilliant. The whole thing was like, the album, the first album was really good. And then we got Jake Burns in from Stiff Little Fingers.
Yeah.
We did that track, which won this award. And it was like, Jake wrote it about, Wilco.
Okay.
And it's called Walking Wounded.
Yeah.
But I'm walking tall.
I didn't know that was about Wilco.
Yeah, it was about Wilco. So he wrote that song. And then there's some great tracks on there with this that Neville's done with Tim from TV Smith. Yeah, some great tracks on that first album. So I met Rat through that, and then we've stayed friends and we've played together ever since, really. And I like Rat because he's very straightforward.
Well, I suppose he's another one who's kind of been there, done it, got the T-shirt.
He doesn't take shit.
Yeah, I can imagine.
No.
But as well, there was an album that you did. I mean, you did Tokyo Nights with a bunch of Japanese musicians and vocalists.
Yeah.
But there was also the other album with the Palm Desert guys like Dave Catchum and
Josh
Chris Utre, Goss.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a total fan of that section of music.
Desert
like
scene.
The desert, yeah. The Palm Desert scene, like Queens of the Stone Age and Screaming Trees and Caius and all that. So, like, how were those guys to work with?
I wasn't a fan. I'd never even heard of them. So for me, it was kind of like, I was kind of like just thinking, oh, we're going to make an album in Joshua Tree. And I contacted Dave Catching. And what happened was, I was talking to Rat. And I said to Rat, what should we do next? He said, why don't we show those Americans how to make real psychedelic music?
Yeah.
He goes, you know, let's show them how it's done. He said, they think they're really good at this, but I think we can be better. So anyway, so we booked the studio in Wandsworth for 3 days. And I said, okay, let's not write anything. Let's go in and write 12 songs in 3 days.
All right.
So we turned up. It was just me, Rat, and this guy called Paul. And we turned up and it was just kind of like, we sat up, started playing, sounded shit, nothing. So came to about 2 o'clock. Thought, go to the pub. So I went to the pub. I said, fuck me. This was a bad idea, wasn't it? No songs. Put the studio for 3 days. And then this massive, great, big black rat ran under the table. And Rat said, it's a sign. We have to go back and play now. So we went back and then the first song went down, which is the one with Chris Goss. That Chris Goss ended up singing on, but it's like 15 minutes long.
Yeah.
15 minutes. So we recorded it in one jam, the first one, and it went out without his vocals. It just went out as we recorded it on BBC. Bobby Friction played it on Six Music, I think.
Right.
In its entirety, you know, the whole thing. And then we went out to the desert. We got everyone involved. People were just turning up, you know, on the day. And I said, like, you know, you're into the scene. For me, I turned up there and I thought, like, this is supposed to be the desert. This is like some fucking, like, someone's house in the middle of a council block, you know, flat or somewhere.
Yeah, it's not quite as romantic as it sounds.
And then they were all like, everyone, like, Rat, and everyone was kind of like, don't be like that, Chris. Don't be like that. But I was kind of winding them up. Like, oh, this is fucking bullshit. I said, let's go back. And then I said, no, we've got to go. So we went there. And they were telling me all the stories about, you know, but I loved, you know, secretly, I loved it. I was just being a grumpy cunt.
So it wasn't quite the experience that you thought it was going to be over at Rancho de la Luna.
Well, it was. It was. It was really good. But it was just that when I got there, it was just, I could see everyone was really excited. And I was just being this grumpy, as I said, bastard. He just wanted to be like, nah, this is fucking bollocks. And so we got there and I was going like, this is bullshit. So we went in and it was like Dave Catching's house. And you know, they were really excited because they were like year into the history of these bands everything. And it wasn't my thing. Hmm. Not that I didn't like it. I'd never sort of really listened to it. So I was kind of like, ignorant to it. So kind of like just being provocative, you know, just being playful and just saying, oh, it's rubbish and it's you might as well go back now sort of thing. And they're going, Chris, no, this is like, and so anyway, so I kind of just messing around and we ended up going to the local pub up the road and then everything just clicked into place. So it's like people started turning up and all these people and like Rat said, you know, and then the Daddy Warhols had a day off and I said, why don't you come down and play and jam on stuff with us? And they came down and we were like, it's like sort of like turned into a massive great party with like drugs coming in off drones and everything and like, you know, amazing. And the album turned out great.
Mm.
And then we gigged it, you know, we gigged it around a bit. So fantastic. Yeah, I loved it in the end. But as I said, I was only messing around. You know, it was like, you know,
be the contrarian.
Yeah, you know, oh, this is bollocks, you know.
Oh, fair play. And you've worked with, like you say, Courtney Taylor-Taylor from the Dandy Warhols a fair amount of times as well. So
yeah, he's great.
Yeah. How did you kind of get to know him?
Well, I knew him through, we did the Wolfman album.
Mm.
I think it was through that. I think I'm trying to think how the fuck we got to know him. So it was like, we were doing the Wolfman album and... you know, I can't remember.
Mm.
And so I think I might have contacted Courtney. And then he said, okay, wanted to be involved. So him and someone else produced a mixy album. And then they came over to London. And Marco was like, we went into the studio. And we had two mixes of the album. One was our mix, and one was Steve Mustard's mix, and one was Courtney's mix, and Courtney taking all of Marco's guitars out. So
that
Marco
went
was
down
sitting
well.
There. Well, Marco was like, honestly, he sat in the, you know, there was a little sofa there, and he looked shocked.
Mm.
He said, "Are you taking the piss?" I said, "No, these are the mixes. They're alternative mixes done by Courtney."
Mm.
So he said, "Well, I thought he liked my guitar playing." I said, "It does, but, you know, apparently guitar's not cool anymore, so you're not on the albums." And then we met up with Courtney in London, and we were in Soho House, and we were sitting there. It was like a civil conversation. We were going to go and see Courtney play with Dandy Warhols, and Marco said to Courtney, "Can I ask you a question, Courtney?" He said, "You like my guitar playing, don't you?" He goes, "Yes, I love it. It's fantastic." He goes, "Why did you take all my guitars off the album?" He said, "Well, because this was another approach." And it was like, he didn't take his guitars off. It kind of, I don't know if you heard it, it was like an alternative version.
Mm, like a remix, almost.
Yeah, like a remix. But, I mean, you know, it's good. It's great what he did. It was really good. Mm. Yeah. No, Courtney's great.
And then, like, I think you've, again, like I say, there's so much to kind of cover.
Can do a part two, don't worry, if you want
to.
Yeah,
yeah. So I'm just thinking there's the Paul Fraser thing. I'm just looking through the amount of acts, but obviously you went on to do because of the psychedelic thing. I mean, when I was listening to 1000 Motels earlier on while I was doing some work, and that's got some real kind of psychedelia on there. Psychedelic bluesy rock and roll stuff. It's a real mishmash of stuff, not quite what I expected from Rat Scabies, if I'm honest with you. it's an interesting set of sounds on that 1000 Motels album, or the two that you've got.
Yeah.
And then obviously the biggest musical jump would be the more recent project that you've got with it's Rude Girl and CC, isn't it?
Oh my god, yeah.
With Jenna Dickens.
Yeah.
How the hell did that come about?
Jenna was, I met Jenna through, that's her real name, Jenna Rugel. She was signed to Sony at the same time I was with Marco. I think she was about 13 or 14, and she was like a child star.
Hmm.
And she went into rehab when she was about 15.
Oh, right. Oh, wow. She was a real kind of child. Oh, right. Yeah. I didn't realise that she was. Okay, right.
And then I didn't hear from her for ages. And then, like, when she came out of rehab, we got back together and we just got together and we did all this stuff, which, you know, is coming out. We've got a new thing coming out in May, and Iggy Pop is going to be playing it all throughout May. So we got, like, you know, he played us the last time around, but he's become a bit of a fan. So he's going to be playing us again, the new tracks in May. I'll send you the tracks, by the way.
Yeah, that'd be cool. I mean, you can't get a more cool fan than Iggy Pop, right? I mean, that blew my mind.
And mine. Yeah. I was kind of like, you know, that is, I guess, no, it is pretty cool, isn't it?
Mm. And so what attracted you to doing the more R&B and hip-hop project?
I didn't really want to do that. It was kind of like just sort of, we just got together and just, you know, it's what happened. I didn't really want to do it at all, you know. It was just sort of, and you know, in my eyes I just play sort of what I normally play, and she does what she plays, and it works. So it's no sort of like method. Yeah, it's not like a formula. It's just works. So I get on with that, and it's quick. I get bored very quickly with writing and recording. So it's like, you know, so we just said, look, let's spend 30 minutes on each song.
Okay.
So we'll write the song in 30 minutes and record it in 30 minutes. So it was kind of like an hour for each song, I think.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, just like really quick. And, you know, I get very bored in the studio, sort of like, I don't know about you, but, you know.
Yeah, it's a lot more sitting around than it is actually kind of doing the playing, isn't it? The playing is like 10%. And the rest of it is sitting around or playing with computers. And I'm not really I'm not really a playing with computers kind of guy, if I'm honest with you.
Same with your bass player. So it's like, well, I mean, you know, I do play with computers, but it's boring. And so I'd rather be just playing and let someone else who's good at it do it, you know.
So do you kind of share production on that, or does she do the majority of that?
I kind of do the majority of the production.
Okay.
And she does, she just comes down and sings. And, but now we've changed it around because she actually is really good at production, but she never did it before. So I said to her, why don't you use what you're good at? So, and she's not ego driven. So she said, okay. So she's just sort of starting to do, we're becoming more self-contained in the sense that she can do everything that we would have someone else do, and I can do everything else. So we just do it between the two of us.
And again, I suppose because there's only the two of you, it's a lot easier to kind of sort out diaries and get in the same room at the same time, and you can be more direct with the songwriting.
Yeah, and her girlfriend is part, you know, she's a visual, her wife is a visual part of the band. And I said to her, you're like Stacey, you're like from Hawkwind, you turn up and you dance. And I didn't say the rest, but I said, you get up and dance. And I said, oh, you remind me of Stacey, and it could be like that. And I imagine all the strobes, and she said, oh yeah. And I was, it was so weird, and you know how things go back to the beginning. You know, so you know, and even what you were saying about prog rock, not prog rock but psychedelia and blues on the album, that's kind of what I started doing, and it's kind of what I'm doing now.
Yeah. So. Yeah. There's a real circularity to a lot of the stuff that you're up to, actually. It's interesting to look back, isn't it? And see all the kind of connections and stuff. I mean, like, cause both 1000 Motels and the Rude Girl and CC projects are kind of, they started in the late 2019, early 2020. So they've kind of been COVID project as well.
Fucking lame, isn't it?
Yeah. How has that been? Has that made things easier or more difficult? Or
To be honest, we've just been getting on with it. It's just sort of like each day as it comes, really. So, you know, COVID was what it is, you know, just sort of dealing with it. And then, you know, cancer came along. So that was a little bit of another thing. So it was COVID, cancer, then beat that, cancer gone. So that's gone, COVID gone. So it's just getting back to playing live. So I'll be playing live with the Dandies in June.
Okay.
And then we've got the new stuff coming out of Rugo and CC in May. And then we've got, me and Rat have got a new album coming out, 1000 Motels album. So it's just sort of, you know, back to normal, really. I mean, I can't wait to get playing live again because, you know, it's what I love doing. I don't know about you, but do you know that?
Yeah, look, I played a gig in March of 2020, just before the lockdown. We were supposed to play another gig in Camden the next week, but it was kind of umming and ahhing as to whether we would do it because it was really starting to become like everyday news, COVID, back in the kind of beginning of March. And then Boris took it off our hands by shutting down the whole industry, which, you know, was good and bad in a way, because I love playing, but we were really in a bit of a quandary about, well, if we go ahead, are we putting loads of people at risk coming out to watch it and all that stuff?
Yeah.
And then, yeah, it was well over a year then before I played anything. And that was with, you know, the kind of local bands that I play in.
Oh, brilliant.
The first Sham gig was, the very first gig that I played with Sham was this massive modern punk and ska revival thing up in Great Yarmouth in October of last year. And it was like the biggest stage I've played on in front of the biggest crowd I've ever played to. So that was a real kind of baptism of fire.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
But yeah, since then, it's kind of, it's all been picking up again.
No, brilliant.
And, you know, there's been a few things having to be rescheduled, but not very many. And it seems to be, fingers crossed, that everything's starting to
pick up again,
pick up and get back to normal again, which I'm really, really looking forward to. But I tell you what, you will probably notice, because have you played any gigs at all since?
No.
The crowds are a lot more, there's a lot more kind of give and take. Like, they're so much more energized. I think. Yeah.
Because
think people have been starved of being able to go and see live music as well.
Interesting.
So, like, it's interesting because you've got like the bands who haven't been able to play for a year and a half or 2 years, and then people who haven't been able to go out to big shows for a couple of years. And there's this kind of real, yeah, there's this real frisson now. Like, there's that it's need and want from both sides, and it really causes a real energy in the room.
Oh, so, I can't wait.
So I hope that it's still like that once you get back to it, and I'm sure it will be.
Well, that's fantastic. I hope so. So are you, what bass do you play?
I've got a couple. I tend to, with the punkier stuff, play a classic P bass Fender.
Okay.
But I've got a Dan Electro DC69 as well, which I quite like because it's really light.
Okay.
And it's got an amazing tone, like the little lipstick pickups. Yeah. They're amazing. And I also play an Epiphone EB3.
Oh my God. Yeah. I'd love one of those.
What about you? What's your axe of choice?
I've just got an old Fender Precision, you know, just like an Ampeg SVT classic rig. So I've got nothing sort of apart from that, really. So I started off with, I had a Gibson, I think it was like called a Gibson Triumph. It was like a weird bass. It had so many pickups and so many fucking knobs on it. It was, but it was short scale.
Oh, yeah. I don't think I've ever played anything short scale.
Oh my God. It was so easy to play. Mm. So it was like, you know, like got that top G. So everything's like an octave above, so it doesn't cut short. So you got all those octaves above, but it was kind of like, I don't know, it was just a lot easier to play, but I didn't like all the knobs and I don't like things with lots of knobs on switches. So, you know,
this is what's brilliant about P bass is it's like volume and tone, and that's all I need.
Well, kind of like what I like about life is things a bit simpler, you know, sort of bass and treble.
Yeah.
Volume knob and, you know, four strings.
Yeah. It's all you need, man. It's all you need. I've also got a full size stand up bass as well.
Oh.
Yeah. Which I don't play anywhere near as much as I should. And it's more of an ornament. And my other half hates it.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Because it's just sat there. It never does anything.
Yeah.
It looks great.
But doesn't it sound great?
Oh, it sounds amazing. And it's got two kind of active pickups on the bridge, on the neck, sorry, and another pickup on the bridge. So I could technically double amp it if I wanted to, but I have no idea where I'd ever need to do that.
Yeah, but you have the option, so it's good. So,
exactly.
Well, I really want to get a double bass. I really want to get one.
I mean, the only reason I've got it, I used to work in a pub. And a bloke came in, he used to do roadieing for Motorhead.
Okay.
And him and his brother were in this band, and it was more of a kind of rockabilly-ish band. His brother played stand-up bass, and he was like, look, my brother, we're sponsored, and we get these things. Like, my brother doesn't play this thing, and he's left it in my basement.
Yeah.
And he was like, do you want it? And I was like, well, yes. Why not? I think it cost me 150 quid.
Oh my God,
it just
so
about
it cheap.
Yeah. And it was covered in like an oil paint mural all over the body, so I took nitromores to it and filed it back down, and it's got loads of chips and dents where little bits of paint has kind of
I love it,
like it's kind
I
of
love it
embedded itself. And it looks brilliant. I just need to find myself a rockabilly band to play in. That's all I need.
Just a rockabilly. I've got the bass. Yeah, I just need a band. No, that's cool. But, you know, you're actually quite an interesting character, aren't you? I should be interviewing you, really.
I've become much more interesting in the past year or two. COVID, it's allowed me to do all sorts of things.
Do you like interviewing?
I do, yeah. I mean, I'm a journalist.
Okay.
But I write for design and engineering magazines.
Okay.
So I've been doing this for like 5 or 6 years, but I always wanted to get into kind of music and film journalism more than anything else. But it's such a competitive area to get into and I don't know anyone. So it was, kind of necessity over want, really.
But okay.
Since COVID, I was laid off at the end of 2020, and I was able to go freelance. And since then, I've kind of picked and choosed what I'm doing, and it's allowed me to do the Sham 69 thing because obviously there's tours and stuff coming. Yeah. Like we're going to do Europe and we're going to do America at the end of this year.
Wow.
Supposed to be last year. That was the reason that I joined, was to do Europe in December, but it all got cancelled last minute.
Yeah, same as everyone's. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, no desk job would ever allow me to do that. So it's all come around at the right time, you know. I think there's a lot of, like you say, there's a lot of circularity with your story and
Jules.
Where I'm at the moment, there's a lot of weird circumstances have all come together to enable me to do this kind of thing. And then meeting Rhiannon, who knows you and a load of other people, and it's just, you know, I like that about life, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you've got a very good vibe about you, and sort of very good. You've got a sort of presence, which to me is also says to me that you should be doing it visually as well. So, like, I mean, we're doing it on audio now, but you know, like more like a, you know, like interviewing visually as well, because you have that presence to do that. So,
well, I'm kind of hoping as things progress that maybe once the world opens up a little bit more, and obviously when I'm on tour with Sham 69, hopefully I'll be crossing paths with people in real life.
Oh,
I can kind of take a camera around with me and do a bit of this while I'm doing that as well. That would be awesome. Yeah. So there are plans.
That's a good idea.
Whirring away, you know.
That's good.
But what about you? What's next for you? Obviously, is it a new single or a new album with
We've done a mini album that's coming out on Universal Music. King Kong is the single from that, which is going to be playing in May. And we've done a single on Cleopatra Records, which is a cover of Goody Two Shoes.
Oh, really?
With Rugel and CC. And he's going to be playing that.
Brilliant.
So it's an odd version. So, yeah, they're the two sort of singles. And then I've got the 1000 Motels album. I've got the Dandy Warhols gigs.
So are you playing bass as a touring member of Dandy Warhols?
I'm going to play flute with them. I'm going to on and be psychedelic flute. So
again, comes back to that first instrument that you were given back in school.
Isn't that odd?
How strange.
I pick it up and I just play it. And it's like there's some magical sort of weird stuff. And I play it on pretty much everything, on every album. It's in this, but it's like really psychedelic. Okay. Yeah. So I pick it up and it's just like, oh, for fuck's sake, the flute again. All right, I'll pick it up. And that, I play Dandy so much now, and I kind of like put it in my coat pocket when I turn up and play with them. I stand in the audience and they call me up and I just walk up, just pull it out of my coat. And it's like, oh, it's that cunt, Chris Constantino. Oh, look. Yeah, he's coming up to play flute, you know. Or it's Chris Constantino coming up to play flute. I don't know if you can use cunt in your...
I can say whatever I want. It's the, okay, it's the internet. Good. It's the Wild West.
Okay, that's cool. So, you know, it's going to be good. So I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to the whole new future and, you know, playing to an audience that is COVID. You know, like you said, hopefully that energy is going to be there, what you're talking about. I'd love to experience it.
Mm. Yeah, I'm absolutely sure you will, man.
I hope so.
thank you so much for talking to me, Chris. It's been such a brilliant conversation. I've got a lot of editing to do, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to do more. Like, if you want to do a part two, I'm happy to do it because I know there's so much to cover.
Yeah.
And if you need to edit it down and sort of, you know, if you feel you haven't covered anything, you don't want to drag stuff out too much, then I'm happy to do another session at any point.
Man, that would be amazing. Yeah. Like I say, I'm going to go away. I'm going to do the edit on it.
Sure.
All the rest of it. What I'm going to do is I'm just going to do the fake goodbye and we'll have a little bit more of a chat now.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Chris Constantino, thank you so much for coming on the show. Thanks for giving me a couple of hours of your evening. And thank you for telling me so many amazing stories and just being a totally inspiring person. I'm so glad as well, obviously, that you'll be getting back to live music after COVID and obviously the cancer. Thankfully, yeah. Cancer-free as well. That's such a great...
No, it's all cancer-free. Yeah, it's all good. So thank you so much for, you know, it was a good chat. So, yeah, all good. And good hearing your stories on the bass. I want your double bass. I'll give you 100 for it.
I tell you what, we'll chat off air about it and we'll make a deal.
All right. Thank you so
all
much.
All right then, man. Thanks very much. Cheers. Talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you.
See, what did I tell you? What a great guy Chris is. Even after 2 hours of talking, I feel like I only just scratched the surface, so perhaps there'll be a follow-up at some point down the road. He actually offered to do it, so I'd be a fool to pass him up on it, right? He also wanted to buy my double bass. perhaps that'll happen too, it'd make my girlfriend very happy. I really do think you should check out 1000 Motels and Rude Girl and CC. They're poles apart musically, but are both really great in their own ways. And if you're at a Dandy Warhols gig in the future, look out for the flute player. If you enjoyed listening to that conversation a tenth as much as I did having it, I'd imagine you're pretty satisfied. Let me know what you thought of it on the social media posts, and be sure to share it in the podcast with your friends. Until next time, take care of yourselves. Thank you for listening to this episode of Band Biographies. If you enjoyed it, please don't forget to leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or whatever service you use to listen to your podcasts. Please do reach out on Twitter at BandBiogs, Instagram at BandBiographies, search on Facebook for Band Biographies, or by emailing bandbiographies@gmail.com. See you next time.